Marriage is a big change, isn't it? With a few vows, you go from single to married. For the ladies, from Miss to Mrs. But that big change leads to 1,000 little changes. You might move house. You might gain a whole new family. You might have to eat new foods. You might spend your time off differently. You might have to be more tidy than you were in the past. That certainly applied to me. And it's the same when you become a Christian. There's a big change. You accept Jesus as your Lord and Saviour, but it ends up with 1,001 little changes. Leads you to be amongst God's people on a Sunday. Leads you to forgive those who sinned against you. Leads you to give generously to those around you. The big change means many little changes. And it was the same for Israel here. So chapter 1 to 16 is the big change. They go from being unclean sinners to clean and holy. They have a relationship with God. And now in the second part of this book, which we'll start tonight, this morning, but we'll carry on after Christmas. We'll go into Christmas soon. But now in this second part of the book, the question is, how do you live in relationship with him? And it's very obvious the overarching principle in verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Holy means separate, other, different. Just as God is different than human beings in a good way, so Israel were to be different from the people around them in a good way as well. Now, not all of these commands are in the New Testament, and we'll explain how that all works out as we go through. But the big principle is, when you have a relationship with a holy God, your life is going to change. You are called to be holy. You are called to be different in a good way. And if we look at this passage's commands, we're going to see some of the day-to-day changes that following Jesus will mean. Now, in terms of structure of this passage, there's some connection between individual commands, but some of them are kind of picked up and then come back to. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through four groups of points, four groups of commands, and hopefully that will make sense to you. So there's holy worship, holy separation, holy justice, and holy love. And we'll begin by thinking about holy worship. When you're married, you reserve your romantic love for your wife. And so it is, or your husband. And so it is with God. When you love him exclusively. You worship him alone. And so the worship described in this chapter could be summarized in commands of respect and reject. Let's start with the worship of respect. God starts in verse 3 by saying, each of you must respect your mother and father, and you must observe my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Now, we'll come back to Sabbaths in a moment. You probably expected that was part of worshipping God. But it's interesting, isn't it, that Jews saw respect to parents as a means of respecting God. They were to respect and honour them throughout their lives. So when you were living at home as a child, you'd respect by obeying them. When you left home, you showed respect by honouring them and providing for them in their old age. And their respect to God was symbolised by this respect to parents. And there was also to be a respect for the Sabbath. So one day was set aside from work to worship. And many couples have a date night each week where they spend time together. Well, in a similar way, relationship with God doesn't work if you don't have time with him. Israel are to make a priority of being with God and worshipping him. And finally, the sanctuary is to be respected. So that's played out in verses 5 to 8 by explaining to eat the sacrifice in its right time. It was showing that they respected the sacrifices that were made. So holy worship means respecting our parents, sacrifices, and the Sabbath. But to worship God also means rejecting something. Rejecting other forms of worship. Verse 4 says this, do not turn to idols or make metal gods for yourselves. I am the Lord your God. The Hebrew word for idol literally means little god or godlings. People knew that the statues in their homes weren't really gods, but they thought, oh, we have this little god in our house that'll help us to worship. But that's not the case. God is to be worshipped in his fullness, not whittled down to a tiny portable form. And that's expanded to other things as well. So verse 26, later on in the passage, tells them not to practice divination, that's dreams that guide you. And they're not to seek omens either, looking to other gods for guidance. Nor are they to turn to mediums or spiritists in verse 31, seeking guidance from the dead. They are to seek worship from God and God alone, seek guidance from him and him alone. Now, how does that apply to us in a very different set of circumstances? Well, the big principle is clear, isn't it? We should worship God. And worshipping him means respecting him and rejecting others. Let's look at the reject part first for us, because it's a bit easier to get our heads around. When we turn to Jesus, we reject other things. Perhaps if we've been following another god through our lives, we will be turning our back on that. But we also turn our back on a whole range of superstitions, horoscopes, dream theories, all that is nothing compared to God's clear word. But we also reject idols, little gods, ways that we whittle God down to our level so that we can understand. Now, there's a reason in our church building that we don't have pictures or statues of God or Jesus, because the moment we picture God, we whittle him down to our level. We minimize him. For example, have you ever seen a picture of Jesus where he really looked like a Middle Eastern Jew? Generally, he's made to look much more like us, isn't he? And that's the God we want, a God who's like us, a God who's not scary or different in any way. Of course, it's not just pictures that causes us to do that. Many of us belittle God in some aspects in our lives. We keep him in certain boxes. He can be like this, but we don't want a God like that. And the Bible tells us to grasp God in all the fullness of his character and to worship him alone. So when we worship God, we reject all of the ways of worship. But we're also called to respect. Respect for parents isn't about being a good little boy or girl. It's a respect for who God gave us to care for us. So kids and teenagers who are here watching right now, once you've trusted in Jesus, your relationship with your parents should have changed for the better. Now, this passage is assuming that your parents are believers, and the New Testament does explain what to do in other circumstances. But even if your parents don't share your faith, you can honour them in many different ways. What of honouring the holy things, the sacrifices here? Well, now there's no temple, there's no sacrifices because of Jesus. But we must remember that our worship always comes through Jesus and honour him and him alone. What about this Sabbath? Well, what's the principle with this? It's to have a relationship with God, you need a day of rest and worship. When you value someone, you make time for them, don't you? Jews met on a Saturday. After Jesus' death and resurrection, Christians began to worship on a Sunday because that was the day that Jesus rose. They met to worship and rest with God and his people. I'd encourage you to use whatever means you can to make it here on a Sunday. Make Sunday your day of worship. It's not always easy in a world that doesn't see Sunday as special, but where it revolves around you, be with your God and his people on a Sunday. Now, some will say, oh, that's legalism. Well, it can be. Legalism about the Lord's Day usually revolves around a list of unbiblical rules, rules God never set down. Rules that enable us to look over on others and think of ourselves as better than them. But at his heart, God is saying, in the Sabbath, in the day of rest, come and spend the day with me. If I think that work or a football match or time with my family are more important, what am I saying about who I truly worship? So that's the first set of commands here. commands to holy worship. Secondly, there's holy separation. Now, technically, those two words mean exactly the same thing. But what I'm talking about here is that there's loads of rules in this passage that are basically arbitrary. They're just there to separate out the Jews from the people around them. So in verse 19, you might have found this weird when we read it before. It says that you shouldn't mate different kinds of animals. You shouldn't plant different plants in the same fields. You should not wear clothing woven of two kinds of material. Now, why is that? Well, as the Jews make sure they obey those things, they're being reminded that they're to be separate from the nations, different from the people around them. Verses 23 to 25 say they're not to eat fruit until the tree is in its fifth year. Now, I'm told that's good common sense. It means that you'll get better fruit by that fifth year. But the point is, more than that, that it is an act of faith that, verse 25, your harvest will be increased if you trust the Lord in this matter. They're again told not to eat food with blood in it. We talked about that last week, so I won't go into that in any more detail. And they're also given a set hair and beard style in verse 27. So they're not to shave the sides of their heads or clip the edges of their beard. So we'd all be in trouble, I guess, most of us blokes, with our short back and sides. And then verse 28, they're not to cut their bodies for the dead or put tattoo marks on themselves. Now, these are all markers of Jewish nationality. Now in Jesus, the purposes of God aren't limited to one nation. They're spread to all the nations of the world. So that means these rules don't apply to us anymore because we're not Jewish. But what they pointed to was that when Jesus came, his people were to be separate. They were to be different from the world around them. Now, we're not going to spend long looking at these commands because mostly they don't apply to us. But there is a good principle here for us. Sometimes being a Christian and keeping God's commands is incredibly socially awkward. Imagine what it was like for the Jews when they traveled to Egypt and Italy and they had to obey these rules. They had their funny haircuts and their funny beards. They had to make sure they ate the right food. It was awkward. And it can be awkward for us too. Everyone's getting drunk at the Christmas party and you aren't. Everyone else is watching a certain movie and you aren't. Everyone you know has certain beliefs and you don't. That's hard. Following Jesus means that we must be willing to separate ourselves from the world around us. Now, the last two parts are probably the most relevant for us. They both talk of this moral separateness. They're holy justice and holy love. Now, technically, you could put those two things together. But in my mind, holy justice is about the formal things. So, work and what happens in the courts. We'll look at that in verses 11 to 16 as holy justice. It starts with verse 11 with quite sensible, familiar commands. Do not steal. Do not lie. Do not deceive one another. But then it's worked out in more detail. Where might you struggle with those things in ancient Israel? Verse 12, do not swear falsely by my name and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. It seems like you know how in our courts you're asked to swear to give the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Well, it seems something very similar happened in ancient Israel. They would swear by the Lord that the evidence they gave was true. Now, of course, Israelite society was a lot more informal than ours. So a court was basically just a bunch of the senior men of the town sitting at the city gates and making decisions. But in that context, someone might say, I swear to God that I will pay you back. Or I swear that I never stole that thing. God is saying that must not be done. Firstly, because it's deception. And secondly, because it profanes God's name. It makes God out to be a liar. Then verse 13, do not defraud or rob your neighbor. We're given an example of that later in the passage. In days where there weren't standard measurements, what some people would do is they'd get a £4 weight and they'd write £3 on it. So you'd be given £3 worth of rice, but you'd have paid £4 worth for it. They were not to defraud their neighbours in that way. That was as bad as stealing. Moreover, they're told, do not hold back the wages of a hired worker overnight. Now, most of us here probably don't get paid the night we do our work, probably paid on a monthly basis, so we might be surprised with that. But most people in those days would have been what we'd have called self-employed. They would have worked their own land and made their own food. A hired worker was someone who didn't have land, and they would have been very poor. So if you say to him, after potentially he's not worked for 10 days, I'll pay you in the morning, it might be that that's another night his family go without food. So prompt payment was essential. Skipping down to verse 15, do not pervert justice. Do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbour fairly. Again, most Israelite men would have been called upon to serve in the courts in those days. And in most of Israel's history, the poor got a very rough deal. We find out about that in the prophets. But there isn't a call to overcompensate here. They're not to prejudge based on whether someone's poor or whether someone's rich. They're to make the right judgment. And then finally, do not slander. Verse 16, do not go about spreading slander among your people. Do not do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. I am the Lord. Now, those commands aren't separate. If you spread lies about a person in regard to them breaking God's law, they could have been put to death. So the point here is that there must be truthfulness. There must not be gossip to bring others down. Now, a lot of this stuff might seem quite familiar because you and I have been raised in a legal system that was based on these laws. So we know that there shouldn't be perjury, there shouldn't be slander, there shouldn't be false measurements. On its best day, our legal system is a good thing that's based on the example of God's law. But sadly, in our society, justice issues have become very political, haven't they? It's divided between the left and the right. I think that's your left, that's my right. The left wing are more likely to stand for racial equality, gender equality, the rights of the poor. The right wing are more likely to stand for religious freedom and the rights of the unborn. We shouldn't buy into this sort of divided thinking that our world has. But justice should mean justice. Justice should mean that the poor will not be taken advantage of for the simple sake that they're poor. Justice means a baby with Down syndrome should have the same rights as a baby who does not. Justice means the colour of your skin should make no difference to how likely or unlikely you are to get a fair decision. Justice means that Christians and Muslims and Jews and Buddhists should have the right to worship on the basis of their conscience and not have it rammed down their throats. And so on and so forth. Of course, it's easy to say society should be different rather than to actually look at our own lives and our own hearts and see where it's true for us. We should look at the principles behind these commands and say, what is true of me? You may never withhold wages from people, but do you perhaps take advantage of those who are under you in the workplace? You may never rob the poor from justice in court, but do you treat those from a poorer background differently than those of a similar social group to yourself? You may never lie in court, but do you ever spread rumours about others in the office? Christians, like God, are to act justly to all. Worshipping a holy God means holy justice. Finally, we get to holy love. If you've read the New Testament, you'll be familiar with the command in verse 18. Love your neighbour as yourself. Jesus says that's a summary of the whole law in relation to others. Act in the way that you'd like others to treat you. But this is made explicit in this passage by telling you to love particular people that you may not want to love. Let's have a look at them. Firstly, you're to love the poor. We mentioned this before in a formal setting. Here's a less formal one. When you're reaping the harvest in your field, you're not to gather up every last bit of wheat or every last grape from your vineyard. You're to leave some on the floor. Why? Well, if a poor person or a foreigner among you who needs food goes to your field and is able to eat from the floor, they will be fed. This is kind of an ancient welfare system to make sure that even the poor could get food. Verse 14 tells us to love the disabled. Deaf people shouldn't be cursed because they can't hear. Blind men shouldn't be tripped over because they can't see. And I think that's more of a principle rather than the expectation that that's exactly what was happening. Most ancient people saw deafness and blindness and disability as a sign of God's curse. But Israel, unlike the other nations, are actually to care for the weak. You're to love your enemies, verse 17. Do not hate a fellow Israelite in your heart. Rebuke your neighbor frankly, so that you will not share in their guilt. If you're struggling with hatred, you're not to keep it bubbling up inside, but rather, you're to rebuke them frankly. You're to say, this is where you've sinned against me. You're to get your problems out in the open and dealt with. In the same way, in verse 18, you're not to seek revenge or bear a grudge, but love others as you wish they loved you. Also, we're to love marriage. Now, verse 20 to 22, that bit about the female slave sounds very strange to us. The idea is that a woman who is a slave and engaged to marry another man sleeps with yet another man. And so there's two things to explain there. Firstly, slavery in Israel was generally something that you chose. So the phrase man-stealing is used of invading a place, taking people, and using them as your slaves. That's what we think of slavery, what we would think of the African slave trade. That was banned outright in the Bible. It should never have happened. Rather, what happened in ancient Israel was, if you were in debt and you couldn't eat, you could become someone's slave. The owner had to care for you, and after 7 years, they had to release you. So it was more like a long-term contract in many ways. So in a world without job seekers' allowance, it allowed people who were in debt to stay alive. And the other thing to bear in mind is that when someone was engaged, as is mentioned in this passage, it was considered as binding as marriage. So this was an act of adultery. So this couple have basically committed adultery, and usually they were either put to death or forced to pay a huge fine. But here there's a special circumstance because the woman who's a slave does not have finances to pay a fine. And so the man who has slept with her is to pay the woman's fiancé her bride price. And he's to make atonement for his sin before God. The woman not being free is able to get away with it, as it were. And the man who slept with her is to pay for it. So that's a very specific situation. But the general principle here is don't commit adultery. Love marriage. We also see we should love women. Verse 29, do not degrade your daughter by making her a prostitute, or the land will turn to prostitution and be filled with wickedness. Prostitution was sadly normal in the ancient world. In most pagan worship, the Greeks, the Romans, the Canaanite religions, you went to the temple to sleep with the temple priestess as part of the worship. And if you were going into debts, a quick buck would be to sell your daughter's body to pay that off. Well, that wasn't to be the case in Israel. Daughters were to be protected and cared for from this fate. Not just your own daughter, but all the Israelite daughters, the whole of Israelite society, was to be protected from that fate. Also, we should love the elderly. Verse 32, stand up in the presence of the aged. Show respect for the elderly and revere your God. I am the Lord. Nat and I were joking yesterday that if we started standing up when people who were older than us in our small group came in, I think they'd all get very offended in what we did. Because in our society, we see age as a bad thing, don't we? People spend a fortune on anti-aging cream and things like that to hide the effects of aging. But for God, the elderly deserve respect. They're often downtrodden, but in God's society, they are to be honoured and revered. And then finally, verse 33 to 34, love foreigners. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not ill-treat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native-born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. When I had my haircut a few weeks ago, I have a Romanian hairdresser, and the guy in the chair next door was subjecting him to some racist abuse because of his background. And as that guy left the shop, the other hairdresser said to him, oh, you just need to get over it. He's only doing these things because you rise to the bait. Is that true? Should immigrants to our country have to deal with the fact they're going to get abused by, for being foreigners? Well, no. The Israelites were to love the foreigners among them, treat them as they wish to be treated. And those of us who were here when we studied Ruth will see that sometimes, at its best, that was put into practice. So that's a very long list, but let me just run through it for you. Love the poor, love the disabled, love your enemies, love marriage, love women, love the elderly, love foreigners. What a difference Israelite society must have been in an ancient world from those around them. There's this idea in our British culture that for thousands of years, the world was bad for people of different races, sexes, or social classes. But thankfully, some people have started sharing things on social media, and that has made the world a better place. No, God has always been teaching this. This has always been God's command. And those that have obeyed God have kept it. Sadly, that's not always been the case, but it should have been, because the Bible has been absolutely clear. There's a reason that slavery was ended by evangelical Christians. There's a reason that Victorian Christians set up orphanages for the poor. There's a reason that the civil rights movement in the 60s came out of churches. The historian Tom Holland traced the history of Christianity through to the present day. And in his book Dominion, he notes that most of what we think of today as being progressive, liberal values is actually Christian. Now, he isn't a Christian himself, but he recognizes that that is where these principles came from. It's not something that has been invented in the past 20 years. Now, of course, Christians have done some terrible things over the years. They have broken all of these commands to love others. But here's the thing. When they do that, they're not doing it by upholding God's law. They're doing it by breaking God's law. God's law always leads to love. Once again, it's easy to say, I'm against racism, I'm against sexism, I'm against ageism. It's a lot harder to check our hearts, isn't it? Do I love that person who wronged me? Do I approach them to deal with it, or do I just simmer in resentment? Do I stick to the crowd of young people and people like me, or do I respect the elderly? Do I make jokes at the expense of immigrants coming into our country, or do I go and help them? We're to have a holy love that's different than the people all around us. Now, as we draw to a close, there's been a lot of laws there. Let's think of the big principles. What are we to do with this list of laws? Well, the first thing we should always do when we come to God's law is we should confess. There are no doubt some areas of this that you don't struggle with. And of course, not all of them apply to you. But I suspect your conscience was pricked at some point. Maybe you've not been making a priority of a day of worship. Maybe you've been failing to show respect to older people. Maybe you've sat in resentment rather than dealing with an issue of sin in your life. The New Testament tells us that one of the primary reasons God gave us the law was to drive us to Jesus. The past few weeks we thought how because we're sinners, we need forgiveness from Jesus. And this passage shows us the standards. It's not a matter of, well, I'm okay because I've not slept with a female slave. God looks at our hearts. If there's not a heart of love for neighbor, then we need a sacrifice. If you're convicted by this passage today, the first thing you should do is look to Jesus. Ask him to pay the price for the sin you have committed. Otherwise, these laws will do you no good whatsoever. Secondly, when you look at this passage, you should praise, because there's only one person who has ever kept this law to the minute level. When we think about Jesus coming into the world, we kind of think, oh, what were those years between him being in the manger and walking around in ministry like? What was he like day to day? Well, as we look at the law, we see what Jesus' life would have been like. What's written in here, that's Jesus. Every time an old man entered the room, even though he was older than time itself, he would have stood up in respect. Every command his mum and dad gave him, even though he was their creator, he obeyed. Every time someone sinned against him, he didn't simmer in resentment, he resolved it. He loved his neighbour as himself. Imagine the beauty of someone living out the laws described here. That's Jesus. The third thing we should see in this passage is we should change. The law is primarily given to make us confess, but it's also used in the New Testament to show us how we are to live. We made clear that we don't need to be concerned about haircuts, but if you've been convicted of something in this passage, don't think, well, Jesus will forgive me anyway. After being forgiven, God calls you to be holy. As he told the people here, I took you out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Be holy as I am holy. So he says to us, I have saved you from your sins. Now be holy as I am holy. Now there's not lots of commands in this passage, but maybe God has challenged you with one in particular. Maybe go away today. Maybe think in your small group about what it would mean to live that out in practice. And finally, when you read this passage, you should anticipate. This society of justice and love never came fully into existence. Read the prophets and you'll see how often these commands were broken, because that's what human beings are like. And it will never exist perfectly now. We'll never have a perfectly just and loving country, nor will we have a perfectly just and loving church. But a day is coming when Jesus will be on his throne, and all that these laws point to will come into their fullness. There will be no poor. There will be no discrimination. There will be no arguments or revenge. Love will rule all. That is what Jesus came to bring. If you see anything good here, then anticipate the day when these laws will be written on every single heart. And everyone in the world will love their neighbor as they love themselves.